I were you, I wouldn't drink. No matter what. Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. By God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous rooms full of people like you and a little effort on my own. I haven't had to take a drink or do any dope since May the 11th, 1976. And for that, I'm especially grateful. Thank you. You're clapping for yourself. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love AA. I love this committee. This is a wild committee. Don, you know, not very many people know this, but Don used to be a cop back east. had to get him off police force because he found out he's dyslexic and he kept giving IUDs. Mike rode his motorcycle down to Reno today. I'm a biker, and I got to come up here and do AA. He's a committee. He's a wannabe, and he rides down there and spends all day, see? And he ran over a rabbit, and it just flattened the rabbit. It was just thin. He stopped, and he was looking at this rabbit, and it's just flat. And a hiker came along and came up to him and said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "This rabbit. I ran over this rabbit, and it just flat." And this hiker said, "Just a minute," and he reaches in his backpack and he pulls out this can of spray and he shakes it up, sprays it on this flat rabbit, and all of a sudden, it just blew up and it's just all happy and it's just fuzzy and it's just standing there and it waves and it runs 4 or 5 feet over there, waves, runs 4 or 5 feet over in the bush, and just for it to get ready to disappear in the bush, waves. And Mike said, "What is that? What was in that can?" The hiker said, "Well, I don't know, but it says here it revives flat hair and gives you a permanent wave." I'm glad to be here. I'm glad my friend Ray and guys he sponsored came up from Redding or Red Bluff or wherever it is over there. And my friend Henry came with me. Henry sits in the back there since you introduced your sponsor. I want to say, Henry, I've been sponsoring Henry for 12 years. He could never stay sober. You know, I told him, I said, "How long are you sober?" You know, he's standing up as a newcomer for 12 years. I mean, he's making me look bad. I mean, he's standing there with one tennis shoe on, a loafer, and one green sock, one red sock, eating a taco and smoking a cigar, and he says, "How do you know I'm drinking?" I said, "Henry, don't stand up as a newcomer anymore." And you know what? He quit drinking. I quit asking him how long has it been since he had his last drink, and he's been sober. One time I told him, I said, "Henry, it must be terrible coming to AA and drinking." I said, "Why don't you go home and just drink? Just go drink." He said, "Really?" I said, "Yeah. Just go home and just get it on. Drink." There's a bunch of guys I sponsor standing around. When I told him that, he walked off. Week goes by, and all these guys say, "You seen Henry?" Said, "No." "So, what's he doing?" I said, "He's drinking. He's following sponsor direction." Day or two goes by, you know, and somebody said, "Has Henry called you?" I said, "No, he didn't call me. He's drunk." About 2 weeks go by, nobody's seen Henry, and everybody starts worrying about him. So maybe Henry's dead. I said, "Well, I never thought of that." "Maybe I ought to call Henry." I called Henry up. I said, "Henry, how you doing?" He said, "Oh, I'm sick. I'm sick, sick, sick. I've been drinking bad." I said, "Well, you ready to come back to AA and sober up?" "I don't know." "Come on back." You know, "Come on back." You know, he came back to AA. Henry's taught me more about the disease of alcoholism than anyone that I've sponsored or worked with or been in a meeting with who came in AA and sobered up the first time. Because he's taught me this is a disease. And just to drink. To drink. Man, you want some bad drinking, you use AA to control drink. That's a bad drink. I love Henry. And Henry's sober. You know what? The amazing thing about it is Henry's working with two or three other guys. And that's a major difference. He never could get sobered up and get to working with other people. And that's a major difference. And that's why he's sober today. Anyway, I brought him. I brought him because he said he wanted to come. And I said, okay. And so we're here. And I'm glad to be here. Glad to be sober. I've been told to, share a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened and what it's like today in a general way. Experience, strength, and hope. And hope is a vision beyond my present circumstances. And I love Nell. Nell's my favorite Al-Anon. It's a special thing to be able to be on a program with the three ladies here that are on this program. They're my favorite ladies in AA and Al-Anon. Spiritual and funny and exciting. And it's a real privilege to be able to do that. And I've been able to enjoy life in Alcoholics Anonymous, this way of life, for a little over 21 years. Unbelievable thing. And I don't come here tonight to give you any sad story or any tragedies. I don't bring you bad news about Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't bring you, a bunch of, years of sobriety of constant pain or turmoil or depression. I'm going to tell you something. I have had the last 21 years, had the most fantastic trip in my entire life. The best deal I've ever had in my entire life, bar none. Unbelievable. Fantastic. And I've had some bad days. Now, don't get me wrong. I've had some real bad days, but I've had 21 good years. And I love it. And I come to share with you the fact that if you work Alcoholics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous works. In a few days, we'll be married to my wife. My present wife, about 37 years, and, we've been together a long time. A lot of people go through a lot of painful things, painful relationships in sobriety. It ain't easy staying with somebody for 37 years either, that takes a little, But she's my wife and my lover and my very best friend. She's not my sponsor, and I'm grateful for that. Very active member of Al-Anon this weekend. She's having a women's conference down in the Orange County area. And every year for a number of years now, they've had a women's conference and bring speakers in. And they call it a woman's safe place. And they all go up on a mountain and talk about us. That's what they say. I know they don't do that. But I got a good relationship with that lady, and she's a fantastic lady, and I love her more than anything. I got a daughter. My daughter is 35 years old, and my daughter's been in the program over 21 years. My daughter's a very active member of Al-Anon. She started out in Alateen. She's a very active member in Al-Anon, and this weekend she's in an international convention over in Italy. She lives in Italy. She's lived over there for the last 12 years, and very active member, sponsors people, done a lot of things in the program over there. I love her very much, and she's forgiven me for all the things that I've done, and my house is in order. I got a father that's 82 years old. The 27th of August, he celebrated 20 years of sobriety. I got 14 months of seniority on him, and I don't ever let him forget it. He's 82 years old, and on his birthday, he played 54 holes of golf and made love to a 69-year-old woman, not once but twice. I want to be just like my old man. We have a good relationship. I love my dad. He's a lawyer, and I've never resented the fact that he's a lawyer. Kept him on retainer for years. We ended up in jail together. I come out black out in jail, and I look across the cell, and here's my dad, my lawyer, my banker, my mouthpiece, laying on the bunk over there in jail, my cellmate, I said, how are you going to defend me if we're both in jail? He said, well, we'll both be in court at the same time. That's all right. He's a character. He kept track of every dime. I'm the kind of guy, borrow 100 from you, pay you 50 back, and owe you 50 for the rest of my life, And that kind. And after I sobered up, I was making my amends list, and I told my dad, I said, he'd sobered up by then. I, had some immediate things to take care of. He was kind of way down on the list there on that financial amends. And he was sober a little while, and I said, you know, all that money I borrowed from you? And he said, yeah. I said, well, I'm going to make amends. He said, you are? And I said, yeah. I ain't never going to pay none of it back. He said, well, I tore the list up, you know. And I ultimately, when I was 12 years sober, between 12 and 14 years sober, I had to pay my dad back. And we come to an agreement on a financial amount, and I gave him the last check. And he looked at it and said, is it any good? Takes a long time for some of those things, I'll guarantee you. But we've been able to, you know, have a good relationship. His sobriety birthday is on August the 27th. That's my belly button birthday. And my father could never remember my belly button birthday. He was always drunk. And he don't forget it now, baby. I'll guarantee it's his sobriety day. You know, so God has a little poetic justice. I'm grateful for that. What I'm trying to tell you is Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, and Al-Teen put a family back together. I came here with a family. That's me. That's what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a mess. I don't know if it's dysfunctional, but it was really screwed up. And amazing thing is that I grew up with selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, neurotic, insane people. And baby, I got out of there alive. And I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous in a room full of selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, neurotic, insane people. And you said, welcome, you're home. Some of the things I learned growing up with my family have saved my rear right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was born in Texas, and that don't make you an alcoholic, but it's a disease in its own, you know. I look back on my past, and I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, but when I took my first drink, an alcoholic was born. And I had an unbelievable desire immediately. I was a hyperactive child. My uncle was a doctor, so he gave me amphetamines to calm me down. To this day, I don't know why you'd give somebody who has an abundance of energy speed, but it's like putting you in neutral. It's like going 190 miles an hour with your feet nailed to the floor. You can see sound and hear color, you know. And I had an acquired taste immediately. I don't identify with anybody specialized. If you're a specialist, that's fine. There's stories in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. 42 stories in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and 17 of them talk about dope. Wonder why. So, you know, find your story. The only thing, I've never had the pap smear. But I was a blackout drinker, and I drank with some cats that would have given me one. You know. Now, don't get me wrong. I did some downers once. I shot some heroin one time. Some people peed on me. And I recognized, you know, there's a P.E. and a P.O.R., and you got to be awake to do it, you know. And I knew which one I wanted to be, so, you know. I didn't want to turn it off. I wanted to turn it on, man. I love the deal. I love the deal. I don't care if it's 50 cents or 50 million. Deal me in. I love the deal. If this wasn't the best deal tonight, I'm going to tell you I wouldn't be here. Them guys over in that chili cook-off thought they had the best deal. They don't now, I guarantee you. It took real willpower for alcoholics to stay out of that room. And I started drinking at an early age, and things happened immediately. Now, I got some character defects that have caused me a little pain along the way. One of them is you can line 10 women up against that wall over there, and I'll get the sickest one out of the bunch every time. Every time. Like, the guy goes in the bar, and he's sitting in the bar, and he throws $100 on the table and on the bar, and he tells the bartender, bring me a bottle. Don't let it go dry the rest of the day. The bartender sets the bottle up there, and he said, you must be going to get drunk. The guy said, you bet I am. I just got out of prison. The bartender said, oh, my goodness. What'd you do? He said, I killed my wife. The bartender said, oh. And I walked off. This little old pre-Al-Anon sitting down at the end of the bar, sitting down there. She's going, right up there. Did I hear you say you're single? That's the kind I get. Like the three Al-Anon, the two Al-Anons go to the zoo, and they're wandering around the zoo, and one says, I want to go pet the gorilla. And her friend says, no, no, stay out of that gorilla deal. We don't need to be around the gorilla. She says, no, I need to go pet the gorilla. So they go over by the gorilla's cage, and this Trianon sticks her hand up. She's petting this gorilla. Gorilla grabs her, jerks her right back in the cage, takes her back in the back of the cage, mauls her, molests her. Her friend runs over and gets the zookeeper. They come, shoot the gorilla with a, you know, tranquilizer. It falls on top of her, and they haul him off to the, you know, hospital. And a couple of days go by. Her friend thinks, well, maybe I better go over and see how she's doing. She goes over to the hospital, and there she is. She's all in cast and traction in there. And friend runs up to her and says, you must be in a lot of pain. She said, you just don't know. He ain't written, he ain't called, he ain't even said no time. See what I mean? Well, I wasn't doing nothing one Saturday night. Just got out of the penitentiary. Didn't have a car, a job, place to stay, money in the bank, and so I started to fight. Wanted everybody to know I was back in town, and I was in this little country dance, and I started to fight. It got out of hand, so I ducked in the woman's restroom. Good place to hide. There's a lady standing next to the door, and I said, tell me when the fight's over, and I went in and hid. Pretty soon she stuck her head in there and said, you can come out now, cowboy. I came out, and the band was playing, and she was handy, and I asked her to dance. And I'm a quick study. One quick dance, I found out she had a job, car, place to stay, money in the bank. And I immediately fell in love. I found out later she finished that fight I started, too, you know. That night I said, where you been? I haven't seen you around. She said, where you been? I haven't seen you around. I said, well, I just got out of the penitentiary. She said, well, I just got out of an unwed mother's home. I said, hell, we deserve each other. I said, stick with me, baby, and I'll take you places you've never been before. I did, too. Most of them, she didn't want to go, but I took her anyway. You know how we are. We started out on a road of rip-roaring insanity. We dated 2 weeks, and they nicknamed us in that little old town. They nicknamed us Hatchet and Hammer. I knew his love because it hurt. Used to beat the hell out of each other and call it foreplay. Now you call it abusive. You know? I after a couple of years in that relationship, why, she said she was pregnant, said I was the father. I don't remember that. I must have been crossing over the invisible line when that happened. I don't know anything about being a husband or a father, any of those kind of things. I don't know, you know, I mean, I don't work. I'm a thief. I like to steal. I have very little guilt, except right when I get caught. Then it's short-lived because you got to hurry up and figure out what to do to get out of trouble, you know. So, anyway, I tried to do the right thing. I said, we'll get married and do the right thing. And we got married and got a little house. And, I can clone anything, you know. And I went over and got a dog for the kid and a cat for the kid. Went and got an Easter bunny. But I got a little run of bad luck there that had ringworm. Gave everybody ringworm but me, you know, how us drunks are, you know. Got this dog, 120-pound German Shepherd dog. They told me to take it to obedience class. I take this German Shepherd dog over to obedience class. This guy's got one of them little weenie dogs on a leash. He lets that dog run out there about 100 feet, jerks and said, heel, bam! Little dog just sit right down. My dog attack him. Shoot his leg. They kicked me out of obedience class for being violent. Take the dog home. Wife said, I thought you was in obedience class. So he got kicked out. Being violent. My kids rolling all over the dog. They were, I said, I don't understand it. She said, it's when he's with you. Had that kind of an effect on people. After a period of time, it became necessary for me to leave Texas. That'll happen to you. And they call them trips geographics. And when I left Texas, they call it unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. Time to go. We seem to have an intuitive knowledge about when to go. Don't take me long to pack either. That's what I like about them crazy women. Don't take them long to pack. They're ready. God, we loaded everything up in the station wagon. Had a dog and a cat and a kid. Throwed all our stuff in this station wagon. I went by this buddy of mine's wife. Her girlfriend worked in a pharmacy. I went in and got a little prescription filled in the baggie. We ran through and took a handful of all the pills in there. Took off for California. It took us a month to get there. Most people could make the trip in 3 days, but we took 30, man. I got lost out there somewhere. I went I took a bunch of these pills, and I was wandering around out there in the petrified forest. Came upon a strange-looking log, and I observed it for about 24 hours. The guy came along and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm observing this log." He said, "That ain't a log, that's dog shit." I said, "It's been here a long time." Finally got to California, I knocked the mirror off the right side of that station wagon, and so her job was to hang out and see if anything's over. I got arrested just as soon as I got to California for having a human rearview mirror. You know. Only way I could keep her shut, mouth shut, you know, I mean, it's just crazy. And the dog would stand behind me and drool all over my neck when trucks would go by. He'd chase them trucks alongside that station wagon all the way to the back window and bang his head against the back window. Fall on the cat, and they'd have a dog and cat fight on top of the kid, and the kid would start bawling, and she'd start bitching and whacking, and I'd start drinking, and we did that one day at a time. Yeah, I didn't live no different than I did today. I used to live like there wasn't no tomorrow. They come here and say, "Live it one day at a time." And no problem. I found a drunken uncle. He found me a house, got a good deal on a house, moved right into this house. Nobody lived in it for a few years, got a deal on it, you know. And there were some hippies living on one side of me, and a motorcycle gang lived on the other side of me, you know. And I understood. I didn't know much about them hippies. I was bandito bad, but I knew them hippies. They were a weird bunch, man. They was taking that LSD stuff and lay in the front yard. They'd take their clothes off and lay in the front yard and watch the sun come up and go down. Weird. They gave me some of that stuff, and I went to see 2001. So be careful, you'll have a bad trip. I think I'm having a flashback now, man. It was wild, just crazy. And I'm one of them kind of alcoholics, you know, that just goes places and do things. And I'd leave my wife and kid at home, you know, and I'd go off and be gone a month or two or whatever, you know. And I'd come home, and I always brought my friends with me. You know, they're the guys that don't want to go home and fight with their wives, so they come over and watch me fight with mine. Stand behind you and say, "Get her, get her." Step to the head of the line, Hoss. She's got a knife up here. My wife took up carrying a 12-inch butcher knife. It wasn't sharp, of course. But, you know, I went home one time, passed out on her 15 minutes into a 2-hour conversation. Sick women don't like that. They want you to get, you know, stay awake and get the what for, you know. And I passed out on my stomach. She stabbed me all over my back. When I came to, I said, "God, something's wrong with my back." She said, "Oh, let me see." You know, they already got to act like they don't know, you know. Peeled my old shirt off my back and said, "You broke out of acne in the back drinking that old rock gut whiskey." Said, "Let me get the rubbing alcohol and I'll fix it." I tell you what, them Baptists down in Texas tried to get me right with Jesus, but I'll tell you, that alcohol bath got me closer than anything I ever had. I'd leave and, you know, go off and do my thing and come home and, you know, think I have to hurry up and do my civic duty around the house, you know. There wasn't a door jamb in my house. It wasn't split wide open. I painted my house, but, I'd lose interest in that. I'd get one side painted and I didn't like the color, so then I'd paint the other side, you know. Didn't like that color. So my house was 3 or 4 different colors. One time I got an airless thing, you know, and it clogged up because, I don't know, maybe I got the wrong kind of paint, so it's just kind of an abstract there on that one, you know. And my neighbor across the street came over one time, and he says, "I'll paint your house for nothing." I sat in the garage drinking beer, smoking weed, and wife come out and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm watching the neighbor paint the house." He paint the house. I asked him how come he wanted to paint the house for nothing. He said he wanted to sell his house and get the hell out of the neighborhood before I corrupt it all, you know. But when he wanted to take that old Corvair and Etzel out of the front yard, that was bad. Them were antiques. You know how you can tell an antique car? The grass grows up through the door, up through the window, and up over the top and makes kind of a lattice over the top. That's an antique. But I figured, what the heck, you know, I'd give him a break. So we towed them babies off, and after he sold his house and left, I brought a boat. A friend of mine had a boat, and we parked it in the front yard. Caught a lot of fish off the back of that boat. We used to shoot the fireworks off on Christmas Eve that we didn't get to shoot off on the 4th of July because he's always in jail on 4th of July. I never got to shoot that fireworks off, but spent all that money on fireworks, and then before I get to shoot it, one time I said, I'm going to do this. I bought it, took it across the street, and I was drinking whiskey, and I just poured whiskey on it, threw a match on it, blew it all up right there. And, you know, makes the kids cry, though. It's crazy. It's crazy. I found myself standing in front of a judge, and the judge talking to me about me, and he had the right guy. And he was talking to me about doing something that I didn't really remember doing, but I was pretty sure I was involved in it. The series of events, why he was sentenced me to 3 to 5 years in the penitentiary. Did not want to go there. Thank you very much. I'd been sitting out in the hallway praying prior to going in to see that judge, and some goof has come along with some AA literature. You know how they are. Hanging around in courthouses, passing out AA literature, and some guy gave me a piece of, you know, some literature, and I thought, you know, ye of little faith, yeah, I'll take that, and I put it in my pocket. That judge hit that old bench, and bam, 3 to 5, I whipped that AA literature out and said, how about this? He said, suspended sentence, get in the back, I want to talk to you. They got me in the back with my parole officer, and they suggested I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't know what AA was. I'd been doing a little B&B myself, but, you know, what the heck, I'd rather do a little A&A than I would, you know, go to the jail penitentiary. So I said, well, I'll try it. And they got an old guy over there, and he came over and talked to me about doing some A&A. And you know, he told me he'd take me to see a meeting, show me where it was, whatever, you know. And I'd been in a fight with a guy, somebody, and they hit me upside the head with a crescent wrench. And I had a big turban on with a big knife-proof earmuff over here on this side, blood soaked through it. You know, I looked good, you know, and... went home, laid down on the couch, and my wife come home. She'd been to see a lawyer, and a different lawyer this time, and he suggested I go to AA. So she said, I think I've been to see this lawyer, and I think you should go to A&A. And I let her think it's her idea. So I figured it'd come to that. And I said, I called a guy in AA today. And he said, there's a meeting over here tonight. Starts at 8:30, and it's over at 10. So I laid on the couch there. And pretty soon she come over and stuck her butcher knife in my face and said, get up. I got up. Went out and got in the old Pinto station wagon. And one of them, they only made them 1 year, that brown, kind of brown. Got a deal on that one. We loaded everything up in that old Pinto wagon and headed over to this church, you know. Now, this is the unbelievable part of an alcoholic. My house is 4 different colors. There's a Harley-Davidson stuck. I did a wheelie going up the driveway and stuck the bike in the front of the house. Left it there. Bunch of old cars, boats, crap out there. Ain't nothing in the front yard that grows. It's all dead. I have driven over the neighbor's yard to the point that they just, you know, they don't even plant grass no more. I've puked and thrown up, been shot at, shot under and shot over and fought and raised hell, cried, prayed, every humiliating thing that an alcoholic can possibly do in my front yard. I go get in a station wagon, my wife and my kid and the dog and the cat, the whole tribe is in there, and they take me over to this church, pull up in front of the church, there's an AA sign out there, and I look at that AA sign, I'm going to go in here and do something about my life, and I look at that AA sign and think, well, I've sunk to the bottom now. If my friends see me going in here, they're going to know I'm ruined. My wife looked at me. She knew I had that approach avoidance. And she whipped that knife out and said, what time is the meeting over? I said, I think it's over 10. She said, I'm going to tell you something, Ace. If your ass comes out of that door before 10, I'm going to gut you. Now, you can keep me in an AA meeting. You got a crazy woman circling the perimeter of the 12-inch booking my head. I may not be an alcoholic, but I'll stay in the room. I may be sick, but I ain't stupid. I went in there and I looked around. And I looked at them people at AA meeting. It was in a town named Placentia. I thought it was in Placenta, you know. I looked at them people in there and I thought, I wouldn't even drink with anybody in here, much less sell them dope, you know. I sat down in there and... they went around the room and everybody said their first name, and I said my first and last name. You know, I thought, oh, well, that's it. I broke my anonymity. My wife would take me over there once a week. I'd go home, lay on the couch, didn't do nothing else, watch TV, laid there, didn't drink, didn't smoke nothing, didn't shoot nothing, didn't take nothing. 4 months. One meeting a week. I go back sitting there and I sit there and count them little old things in the ceiling and count them things, count the light bulbs, count the hairs on the back of your head. You know, I'm sure that they, you know, that they read all the stuff and talked all the stuff and everything, but I wasn't really, really an alcoholic. And if you ain't really, really, really an alcoholic, you ain't really an alcoholic. And I wasn't really an alcoholic. I was just maybe a little bit alcoholic or about to, you know, be an alcoholic or something like that. You know, but they were alcoholic. I could tell they were alcoholic. I wasn't alcoholic. I knew it. I went next door and asked them hippies. I said, when I drink, you know. Well, there was a guy with a name Doc, another guy named Professor. And I went over there and I said, hey, Doc, when I drink whiskey, I go crazy. You think I'm an alcoholic? He said, no, I think you're an Indian. I'll be damned. Said Indians shouldn't drink fire water. Well, it must be. My grandpappy was an old Indian fighter for 50 years, fought my grandma every day. You know? And I asked him, I said, what am I going to do if I don't drink? They said, we smoke tie sticks. So what do you do when you smoke tie sticks? Oh, we hang around the park, wait for the ice cream truck to come by. I never wanted to wait on no ice cream truck. I wanted to rob the ice cream truck. But what the hell? I was an Indian. I might as well have a reservation, you know. So I stayed sober for 4 months. Didn't drink or do nothing. After 4 months, beat the deal down at the courthouse. I'm sitting in my house. I look around. Dog's laying next to me. He's happy. I pat him on the head. Kids over here pat her on the head. She's doing fine. The cat's in my lap purring. She's in the kitchen. I'm back in the big bedroom. Beat the deal at the courthouse, and I thought to myself, self, you have prematurely gone to AA. I know I'll be there someday, but I'll be old like Bill, and it'll all be over, you know. So I dropped in on him and resigned from AA. I dropped, said, I think I ain't going to AA no more. I said, you must be going to go to B&B. And I said, I don't know, what's that? And he says, I don't know, but where you're going sure as hell ain't AA. And boy, they weren't kidding. Next 4 years of my life, I drank. And I don't remember much that went on in AA during that period of time. I remember some old fool said, you keep coming back and the quality of your dilemma will improve. What'd that mean? You know? I remember one old guy said, we won't guarantee after tonight that you've had your last drink, but we'll guarantee after tonight you'll never enjoy another one. Hated him. I wanted to go over there and run over him in the parking lot. Ain't nothing worse than having a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. You really know you're a loser. I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, half drunk, half sober. I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I went to one of them things, marathon. Had meetings all day long. Got drunk and sober 4 times in one day. Right in AA. That's a bummer, man. I'd get up and go out in the car and drink a pint, get a little buzz on, come back, drink a cup of coffee, and sober up, you know. Come out of a blackout in an AA meeting once. Now, that may not scare you here, but down in California where I'm from, it'll scare you because you don't know who brought you. You know? And my life changed. I know what it's like to stand in front of the kitchen door and take a drink off a bottle of vodka and look down the hallway. Little 9-year-old girl standing down at the end of that hallway, and she got her chin on her chest and her hair in her face. Standing down there at the end of that hallway looking at me like a wounded animal. She didn't say, Daddy, what are you doing? Come play with me. She looked at me and I looked at her. Turned around and took a drink. I didn't have to have that drink because of the shame that I felt. Hell, you can go way past shame. Way past shame. I had to have a drink because the phenomenon of craving inside of me made it absolutely necessary for me to have a drink. I know what it's like to stand in my bathroom and look at me in that mirror. And what's looking back at me is something I can't even imagine anymore. And what I'm putting in me, I don't even know where it come from. I don't even know what it's going to do. All I know is that there's a constant prayer 2 inches behind my belly button that whatever I put in me, I just pray it works. And looking in that mirror, I look in there and I see a little 10-year-old girl looking through the hole in the door in that bathroom where I probably stuck my foot or my fist one time. And just for a second, moment in time, her eyes meet mine And she's looking at me in that mirror, and I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that this thing has me. I don't have it. She didn't say, "Daddy, come play with me. Please don't beat me and Mommy anymore." She didn't say anything. She looked at me, and I turned around, and I put that stuff in me because I didn't have any choice. When I looked back in that mirror, she was gone. I know what it's like to crawl out of the back of that house needing a drink, screaming, "Everything about me needs a drink. There's something 2 inches behind my belly button that needs a drink. I need a drink. There's something screaming inside of me that takes all of me. It don't have time for prayers. It don't have time for any kind of emotional or any kind of a, you know, spiritual thought. It don't have time for any kind of begging for anything. It don't have time for anything else. There's something screaming inside of me. It's beyond any help." And I crawled down that hallway into my daughter's bedroom, reached underneath the bed, pulled her piggy bank out and busted it. Yet the alcoholic ego, I'm separating the pennies, nickels, dimes, and the quarters because a big-time spender like me and be going to a liquor store, the connection's out with no pennies in there. I'm going to be showing silver all the way. And on my hands and my knees, separating that money, I got eyes in the back of my head, and I look over my shoulder and little 11-year-old girl's hiding in the back of that closet behind me. She didn't go to school that day because she had a black eye and a busted lip, and I'm pretty sure that on any given time it could have been me drunk doing that, or it could have been her mother sober doing that. It didn't make any difference. Hell, we looked that way all the time. All of us did. She didn't stay home because she was ashamed of the way she looked. She stayed home because if she'd gone to school looking like that one more time, the cops would have come and got Daddy and they'd take him away, and that gives them a rest. But I get out. And when you put me away like that, I get out, I come home, and then there's hell to pay, so it was just easier to stay in that closet. Now, I don't know about you. Maybe some of you have been there. What's even worse, maybe some of you are going there, or maybe some of your children are going there. I don't come here tonight to share with you terror, bewilderment. It's part of my past. That's where I came from. The animal's in the cage, but the door ain't locked. And I share with you on my hands and my knees, needing a drink. I'm going to tell you something, this for me, for my kind of alcoholic. There's a lot of well-meaning people stand behind podiums around Alcoholics Anonymous and talk about this being a thinking problem. And it is. It's a threefold disease. But don't ever forget the phenomena of craving. The phenomena of craving is the screaming 2 inches behind your belly button for a drink that a prayer won't do nothing about. There is a phenomena of craving that kills more people in Alcoholics Anonymous today because they think they can put all that different kinds of stuff in there and it sets that motor. That phenomenon of craving is not a thinking problem, that's a physical problem. And on my hands and my knees, I give my kid a break. I let her shoot out behind me without inflicting any more pain in her life. Because the phenomenon of craving 2 inches behind my belly button made it absolutely necessary for me to go ahead and get that money so I could go someplace and feed that thing. Because it needed something immediately. And I lived that way, not a day or week or month, but I lived that way for the next 4 years. You can take everything away from a human being. Money, property, prestige, people, places, and things. Take all those things away from us and we'll still be a human being. But once you lose your dignity, you've got nothing left to lose. And you're as near an animal as a human being could be. I sold my soul for a drink. Because of that phenomenon of craving. You be an alcoholic or an addict. I hope you never, ever, ever forget that phenomenon of craving. I hope you never forget that screaming 2 inches behind your belly button, that gnawing, that cold taste in your mouth, and that something that just is like a locomotive with the brakes on spinning its wheel. Because it's there. And when it's like that, nothing can stop it. We read it in the ABCs all the time. No human power. And God help you if you get in front of me. Now, I don't come here to tell you about that. So that you can feel the pain of that. You got your own pain. Tonight, I stand here before you to tell you something. Hope. I heard Nell say it back in Oklahoma one time. Hope is a vision beyond your present circumstances, and I share with you tonight hope. Right now, this minute, this very minute, this second, this heartbeat. That little girl hiding in that closet behind me, she's a beautiful young woman. Tall, beautiful. Beautiful. She lives in Milan, Italy. She's a professional model. She's modeled for the last 12, 13 years old. She's 35 years old and she's still modeling. It's unheard of. model for some of the greatest clothes designers in the world, a ramp model. And you see, you can't get from that closet to the ramp at the Paris Fashion Show logically. You just can't. It has to be spiritual. Spiritual. Now, I'm not going to take credit for any of that because Alateen Al-Anon has given her that. But what I share with you, hope, in your life, you may not identify with my story, but you got your own or you wouldn't be here. And tonight, this very minute, that little girl loves me as a father. She's forgiven me as a father. You know, I know that. 1 o'clock in the morning. 1 o'clock in the morning. She lives in Milan, Italy, 9 hours ahead of us. 1 o'clock in the morning, not too long ago, I get a phone ring. I wake up. I get up at 3 every morning to go to work. And at 1 o'clock in the morning, my phone rings and it's my daughter. And she's got two little girls there. One's an alcoholic and one's an Al-Anon. They're sisters. And their mother just died of alcohol poison. Their father just blew his brains out and their brother ran away. And they're sitting in my daughter's house. And the little girl that's an alcoholic is sober. And my daughter sponsors her sister. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. And the phone rings and I pick up the phone and it's my daughter. And she said, "Daddy, I need your help." She said, "I tried to say everything I could say and it's just not working. And I thought of the strongest person I know, and I thought of you. Please give me something to say to this little girl, because she wants to go get loaded." I didn't say, "Let me get a cup of coffee, turn the light on." Automatically, I started talking Alcoholics Anonymous. Automatically, I give her a sentence or two, and automatically, I shut up, and automatically, she took what I said and translated it in Italian. And then she said, "Give me some more," and I gave her two or three more sentences. Automatically, I gave her some experience, strength, and hope because that's what I've been trained to do. And automatically, she gave it to that other little girl. And automatically, we did that. Automatically. You see, you can't do that if your house ain't in order. If I'd have just been sober, running around in Alcoholics Anonymous, acting like I did whenever I was drunk, even though I was sober, my daughter never made that call. That's hope. That's beyond anything I ever even imagined. If I could imagine anything else that would forgive me, you know, and it would help her and I build that relationship, I couldn't do it. The only thing that I've been doing is doing things in Alcoholics Anonymous, working with drunks. To believe in Henry for 12 years, drinking every day, and love Henry and believe that he could stay sober someday. To believe that he could stay sober someday. I'm going to give you the magic Alcoholics Anonymous for me. It was given to me. It was given to me by a very precious man. I've had some good teachers in Alcoholics Anonymous. They gave it to me very, very special, the hard way. They gave me a story, kind of explains it. A blind man standing on the corner, and he's got his CNI dog sitting there next to him. Pretty soon the CNI dog, he pees on the blind man's leg. There's a couple of people standing next to him, and the blind man sticks his hand in his pocket and pulls out some candy, and he's holding that candy down. The guy standing next to him said, "Blind man, your dog just peed on you. Why are you going to give him candy?" He said, "I'm trying to find his head so I can kick him in the ass." And that's the way they did me. They finally captured me. And they found my head and kicked me in the ass. And they said, "Get busy working with drunks." And I ain't quit doing it yet. And I wasn't easy. I tried to work the steps. I did them the best way I could. I did them. I've always run at those steps. I've always done things. When I came to AA, I owed $250,000 to people that you can't write them a letter and say, "I'll send you $100 a month. I had some problems. I had a wife that was nuts. You know, I didn't know what to do. I didn't have a clue. I had hair down to my ass, a beard down to my navel. I didn't wear underwear or socks. I travel light. You know, here I am. Guns on me that if you'd have bumped into me, there'd have been a mushroom cloud, you know. And they drew straws to see who was going to sponsor me. And this guy named Rotten Ron got the deal. He won. And he said, "I'm your sponsor." I said, "What's that, a friend?" He said, "No, if you want a friend, get a dog." I had one. He hated me. You know? He come and got me and took me home, dropped me off. I went up and knocked on the door, told my wife, "I got to go to AA every day for the rest of my life. What are you going to do?" She said, "Oh, I've been going to Al-Anon. The kid's been going to Alateen. The dog's been going to Alley Dog. And the cat's been going to Alley Cat. What are you going to do?" I didn't know. went with my sponsor, had an old box van with them plastic milk crates in the back. We'd sit on and grab a hold of them things. He'd run up, hit a light, we'd all slide up the front, and then he'd goose it, and we'd all go to the back, and we'd go to the meeting, sit in the meeting. Just radiate hate, you know. Told me to write, I'd get a pencil, and I'd write. It looked like I wrote with a Hershey bar, you know. I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew all that stuff. It just, you know, but it's just like I got it tattooed on my forehead. You ain't nothing. You're never going to be nothing. So just, I mean, my wife's Al-Anon sponsor said he may be as good as he's ever going to be. Moving right along, you know. I mean, I did an immoral inventory, a fearful inventory. I did them all. You know, I mean, I just, you know, I did, you know, trim my hair a little bit, you know, my beard, and they took me down, got me a, you know, suit of clothes and elected me secretary at a Sunday morning meeting, you know, and got me some green underwear at this Army surplus and some green socks so I could wear them 3 days, turn them inside out, wear them 3 days, you know, and do the laundry. You know, you got to get that down, you know, you get a system. They got me secretary of that Sunday morning meeting, and I'm over at the Sunday morning meeting, you know, and I'm secretary. They'd always lost money. 200 people came. We got $42 in the seventh tradition, you know. I mean, it's like, you know, and they had a cake every week, and so I made a cake out of plaster Paris, you know, saved a little money on that deal. And I'm standing over there. This guy named Bob the Cop from Covina, he came up, you know, he's sober, and he's on the bomb squad, and he come up, you know, me and him used to stand around, you know. Think about those things, and he gave me a grenade here. And I was having a little trouble on the freeways, you know. I was having trouble driving one car. He gave me this grenade, and he said, just play like when you're going down the freeway, when somebody cuts you off, just in your mind, imagine you throw that grenade up in their front seat, you know. So it was working. I was holding my grenade. Somebody make me mad. I just think I took this grenade on your back pocket, you know. You know, my grenade was, you know, I could understand the grenade better than the big book, you know what I mean? I was standing over there one day in the Anaheim Alano Club. My sponsor stood on the other side of the room. He wouldn't even stand next to me. Newcomers would come in, and he'd get them over there and talk to them. I asked one of them new guys one time. I said, what did my sponsor say about me? He said, your sponsor said, if I go out and drink, I could end up like you. I mean, sometimes the best you can be is the group's bad example. You know, I hated them. At 3 years sober, I mean, I'm in the hospital. They had to pump 9 pints of blood back in me because I'm bleeding out of every opening of my body. Just hate. There ain't nothing worse than having to deal, not knowing what the hell to do with it. I worked all the steps. I've done all this stuff, you know. And you can't give something away you ain't got, you know. I mean, I just radiated hate. People would sit down next to me and get up and go get a cup of coffee, and they wouldn't come back, you know. And I just like, they had to put 9 pints of blood back in her. My wife came over there and a bunch of Al-Anons, and they were looking at me, and that doctor said, you know, he bled so much that he only have, you know, so much blood, and we had to put 9 pints of blood in him. If he'd have sneezed, he'd had brain damage. My wife said, how would we have known the difference? You know what it says, no matter how far down the scale we've gone, man, some of us are way down on that scale, see, and I was standing around there fondling my grenade, and I look around, and here's a weirdo standing next to me, the weirdest looking guy you ever seen. He wasn't short enough to be a midget. He wasn't tall enough to be a man. Weird guy. Had hair sticking everywhere. Had one of them little strawberry welder's hats on, pulled down over one ear. And I said, why don't you comb your hair? He said, I did. I said, I'll be damned. He said, what do you want? And he said, will you be my sponsor? I mean, I was kind of waiting on a doctor, a lawyer, or somebody to, you know, a parole officer to come by, you know. Some of that water. I said, here, hold my grenade, you know. I went over to my sponsor, and I said, see that weird over there? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, he just asked me to be his sponsor. And my sponsor said, I know, I sent him over. Go over and tell him you'll be his sponsor and do exactly what he says. Now, that don't even make sense to me today. You know, I didn't argue with my sponsor because when you argue with sponsors, they go nuts and embarrass themselves. So I went back over. Told the guy, I knew the deal. I knew my sponsor had been trying to help that guy, and it wasn't working. He's going to lay him on me. I was going to shape him up, and then he's going to take credit for us both. I knew it. It was obvious to me I knew a whole lot more than they did. I went back over and said, give me my grenade. And I said, come on, let's go. By then, when I came, I had an old pickup truck, and Harley-Davidson wouldn't start. So by then, I was 3.5 years sober. I got me a big AA car. I'd have a big AA car, park it right out front, give the newcomers hope. How you doing? Look at my car. Have $100 or so to buy ice cream for all the people who want to go to ice cream, you know. And so I got him in my car, and we started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he'd talk, sick stuff. And then he'd say, you ever do anything like that? And I said, yeah, I did some stuff like that. And I started telling him some of my stuff. And he said, man, you're sick. That's the sickest crap I ever heard in my life. You know? He started telling me some of his sick stuff, and some of it was pretty bad. I had to kind of embellish on mine because you can't let them one-up you. I'm from Texas, you know. Picked him up one morning. He said, you know, I know that stuff you told me last night was a lie. And I said, how do you know that? He said, because it's physically impossible to do what you said you did. I went home and tried it. you got to stand up in a hammock on your head. We go over there to hear a spiritual giant talk, and after the spiritual giant talk, while I get him out in the Lincoln, I'm laying it on him, and he said, we need a miracle. I said, what? He said, we need a miracle, man. We're hopeless. We need a miracle. I said, like what? He said, like the parting of the water or something we can believe in, you know, burning bush or something. I was thinking if I had some lighter fluid, I could torch this hedge over here or something. Had a .45 automatic in the glove box, got her out, run around in the chamber, shoved it upside his head. I said, I'll count to 10. You pray. So, if I don't have a floating resentment and decide to pop a cap on your ass, you just done step 3. How's that? I did. Counted real slow. Laid the hammer back, throwed it in the glove box. He jumped out of the Lincoln, run in that meeting where my sponsor was. Rat finked on me. Showed my sponsor that ring on the side of his head where I put the barrel of that gun. Told my sponsor I put a gun inside of his head and made him do step 3. My sponsor said, yeah, I know, 80 spiritual. You know, I mean, I know that sounds sick. Worked on him, didn't work on Henry. He'd already heard the story. I moved out of the old neighborhood, moving right along, you know. And it got me a house with a concrete driveway. No oil in it. You know, that's spiritual. When now he gets him a concrete driveway and with no oil spots on it, well, that's you're doing okay. And by then I was doing a little transcendental meditation, naked, cross-legged in the middle of the floor, moving right on. You know, you got to get into that other stuff. And there was a knock at the front door, and I go to the front door, and here's this weirdo standing at the front door. Looked like half of him is stuck in the concrete, and the other half of him is going to Tijuana. Had a big book in there with paper stuck in it. And I said, what do you want? And he said, I want to work the steps like you did. I was trying to remember how I did them. I remember the first step says I'm powerless. And I said, I'm powerless. Come on in. And he came in the house. I said, I know my life's unmanageable because it looks like you're going to be here a while. But I'm crazy. You're crazy. We must be on step 3. He said, you ain't going to put that gun to my head again, are you? And I said, no, we're going to go in the kitchen, get on our knees, do the third step prayer. We went in the kitchen, got down on our knees, and he cuddled up underneath my arm, you know, and I had that tingling sensation, questioning my sexuality, hell. Everybody's hugging around here, you know. Cat walked by and looked at us weird, and I figured, oh, Jesus Christ. He jumped up and threw a bunch of blank paper in front of me and said, I want to do my 4-step. I said, you're supposed to have that done before you get to your sponsor's house. He said, I can't write. He said, how about if I talk and you write? He started talking, I started writing. And said, you ever do anything like that? And I said, yeah, I do some stuff. Like, I started telling him some stuff. A couple of things come up I forgot to tell anybody. You know, more will be revealed. I knew he couldn't read. God was in the room, so I just put a little of my stuff in his. What the hell? God don't care. Get it out. Woo! Set me free. We burnt that one, I'll guarantee you. Yeah. He jumped up and kissed me on the cheek and said, I love you. And I figured, that's it. Divorce her and follow him. Run out front yard and wave real big and said, I love you, and away he went. And I knew something. It's the first time in my entire life that I ever listened to anybody else for any length of time without thinking about me. It went from the head to the heart. And I sit there in front of that guy that day, and he talked to me about things that he did. I'm a very firm believer that if you're going to listen to a fifth step, for me anyway, I got to look you in the eye when you tell me. I do that for me. Because I can sit there. I mean, it's a two-way thing, sitting there for the first time in my life. See, when I gave my fifth step to my sponsor, I gave my stuff to him. And I was supposed to move on to the other step. So I just zinged right up there into 8 and 9. And 6 and 7 was kicking my ass. And I couldn't understand why. And I was having trouble with 8. And when I started listening to those fifth steps, and I started sitting there watching you in the eye when you told me your stuff, even though you didn't know what it was you were feeling, I knew you were feeling bad about doing it. And I'd done the same damn thing and never lost a moment's sleep, and I knew I was wrong. I knew I was wrong. And when I sit there and look that guy in the eye, he talked to me about things. No big deal things. He talked to me about how his daughter came home from school. She cut out one of them little flowers, you know, the kids make. She fold the paper up, cut out a little flower. She came home, crawled up in his lap, and opened the flower up, sang up, and a whole bunch of little flowers popped out. And she said, Daddy, I want to give you a flower that'll never die, because I love you because you're sober. And me and that guy sat in my kitchen and cried. Now, you see the guys I ran with, if I would have talked about stuff like that, the next time they would have seen me, they would have said, here comes the flower guy. I got a lot of those experiences, and I draw from those. Those are my strength. Those are the spiritual muscles that I walk with today. And I've listened to over 500 fifth steps in 21 years. I don't tell you that to brag. I tell you that because I learned right up front that the state of Texas was wrong. The state of Texas said I was a sociopath and I had no conscience. There's textbooks that say if you have more than 6 tattoos, you're sociopath or psychopath. I got a collage on me. But sitting and listening to those fifth steps literally gave me a conscience. You showed me what the consequences are of my actions if I act like that. It literally gave me something to reference from. And I loved it and I did it. Not everybody stayed sober. You know, I'm not telling you that. I'm just telling you what it took for me. What it took for me. It took that. And I still do them. I still do them all the time. I still do them. I work with newcomers all the time. I work with drunks. You know, people stand at this program and say, you know, after years of sobriety, you should work with drunks. And then they don't ever talk about working with them. I've been telling that story about that little guy ever since I got up here. And sometimes I think, why don't I tell that? Everybody laughs and all that stuff. That's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what saved my soul, working with them drunks. Got me out of me. I've been with that lady 37 years. 37 years we've been together. I've never worked on that relationship in the last 21 years. Not at all. I work on me and my relationship with my God, and that relationship is fine. Now, there's an amazing thing. When I sit there day after day after time and listen to alcoholics tell me in the fifth step about infidelity and about the pain and all the problems that they went through with that, some reason, it kept me from cheating on my wife. And I woke up one day at 15 years sober and it dawned on me that I hadn't cheated on my wife in over 15 years. And she hadn't cheated on me as far as I knew. And it dawned on me that listening to the pain and those fifth steps of that kind of stuff had given me the consequences of those actions, and I hadn't done it over here. But the magic of that is the fact that I had a relationship over here that had trust in it. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't trust anybody because I wasn't trustworthy. I mean, I a lot of those things I knew about. I can't do that and stay sober. See? There's things that you got to know. If you're new or relatively new, you've been around here while you have trouble, it isn't just I ain't going to drink and then I'm going to go on down the road. That ain't it. There's more to this thing. You get out of it what you put into it. There was some absolutes for me. absolute. They're just as absolute today after 21 years as they were at 21 days. I haven't cheated on that lady. I haven't hit that lady. There's no physical violence. Had to stop in order for me to stay sober. I haven't written a hot check in over 21 years. I cutted paper all over the country. Had to stop. Now, I'm not going to stand here and tell you I'm a saint, because I have me some character defects that are really rippers. And character defects are not a character defect to me if they don't bother me. It may be driving you bananas, but if it don't bother me, it don't bother me. And I would sit there and listen to those guys give me their step work and watch them and listen to them. And I'd go to their house. Man, you sponsor guys. I sponsor guys. I go to their house. You want to know how a guy's doing? Go to his house, talk to his kids. See? Get around and see if they flinch and all that stuff. See? Go over there and listen to the wives. And I'd go to the newcomer's house and look at those things. Then I'd go over to my house and I'd look at my wife. I'd look at my wife. And I'd see if I saw the same look on her face that I saw over in that house. I became aware of the consequences of those actions. And I didn't want to live like that. I didn't want to live like that. And 10 years sober, I had me a 10-year surrender that won't quit. Woo! Hot damn! I love them sobriety surrenders. Ooh! Man, they get you right with Jesus. And I'm grateful for the old timers and Alcoholics Anonymous. There's two kinds of old timers and Alcoholics Anonymous, in my experience. There's the old timers and Alcoholics Anonymous. Listen to you run around here, shoot your mouth off, and then when you hit the wall sober, they'll look at you and say, I've been waiting on you to do that. You little son of a bitch, you deserve it. You know, turn around and walk off. They will. They will. Don't know why, don't need to know why. Probably the same reason there's people in Alcoholics Anonymous I wouldn't have drank with, and I won't share my sobriety with them either. But there's old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous that wait, and they pay attention. And they wait for the timing. The timing. They wait until you hit that wall. Bam! And they're there. And they say, come go with me. I've been there. I'll show you the way. And they'll walk you through it. God, I love them old timers. I love them old timers that will get you by the hand and say, come on. You know what they did with me? 10 years sober, my ass has fallen off. They took me to participation meetings. They get your ass in a participation meeting and sit in here and tell people you're 10 years sober and your ass has fallen off. I said, I don't want to do that. What's a newcomer going to think if I'm sitting in here 10 years sober and I say my ass is falling off as a direct result of my actions? I said, they'll identify. You will get more people ask you to be their sponsor than you ever thought of. Man, I go to meetings. I was going to meetings 10, 11 years sober, trying to walk through these things in my life, trying to take care of business. And I sponsored more people during that period of time when my ass is falling off than when I wasn't. I'd sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and sometimes it was the only time I could sleep. The only time I could sleep. 10, 11 years sober, sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd go to sleep. Somebody tell my sponsor, hey, wake him up over there. It's a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor said, it's the only time he can sleep. He can't sleep when he goes home. Let him sleep. It's the only time he feels safe. I'm glad there's old timers that do that. They love me enough to walk me through it. Get me on the other side of it. I'm glad there's old times. I'm glad there's newcomers that will stick with you because they don't have any more sense. I got such a big deal in Alcoholics Anonymous one time, sponsored 65 people. My character defects was running rampant, and all of a sudden I didn't have nobody. Man, they abandon your ass quick around here, I'll guarantee it teaches you the whole deal. And I've been through it all. I've been up and down, round and round. Best trip I ever had in my entire life. Bar none. Because I wake up every morning, I'm okay with me. I've been around and around all day long today. I've been up and down, round and round. I've been with the tall ones, short ones, the rich ones, and poor ones right here today. Ever since I got up this morning to this moment, this heartbeat right now, I haven't seen anybody or thought of anybody that'd rather be than me. I don't have to outthink, outperform, or outmaneuver anybody. It's the greatest freedom I ever had in my entire life. It's hardest thing I ever did in my entire life. But it's the greatest freedom I ever had in my entire life. And that's what I came here for. Freedom of bondage itself. Carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to another alcoholic. Carry the message to somebody else, to give it to them for fun and for free. Just for the hell of doing it. Staying a little late after a meeting talking to the guy in the parking lot. Standing out there and saying, you know, I know this sucker's probably going to drink anyway and I got to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Well, what the hell? Maybe I need to hear myself say something. And you stand out that meeting. Go down to that meeting early and stand down there. I worked with a lot of young people. My wife and I, for some reason, I don't know why, must have done something real bad out there. But all these young people come and start asking us to be their sponsor, and we start sponsoring them. Working with a lot of young people. I do it mainly because I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want Alcoholics Anonymous to stay Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, there's no better way than to teach the young people what Alcoholics Anonymous is. And I work with a lot of young people, but it's the most disheartening thing there is. Because the young people have to go through a tremendous amount of those pain that I went through drunk. After they sober up at 15, 16, 17 years old, they have to go through that stuff if they stay sober the rest of their life. They'll have to go through those things because those are just life. And I've buried some of them. I've raised some of them and had them turn their back on me. And let's go get another one. God bless it. I love it. You know, I love working with them drunk. It's a God-given thing. If you're new relative, new, I hope you can do that. I hope you don't miss that. I go into a lot of penitentiaries. I've been very involved in hospital and institution work. I've gone into penitentiaries. It's one of the things, you know, my wife and I get to go around here and talk a lot. You know, and people ask us here tonight or ask me, you know, say, well, how many times you do this? You know, and I do it 40, 50 times a year. I do it, well, primarily I do it because I beat a man to death with my bare hands and I'm still making amends. That's why I do it. But you can't stand behind these podiums day in and day out, week in and week out for years without feeding the ego. And every week I go into a penitentiary, and when I walk into that penitentiary, it takes me off this podium and puts me right down there in the trench. And it puts me right down in there in the nitty-gritty with them guys. I've been going into Chino Women's Prison for over 12 years. I never had a dark night. Never had a dark night. 160 women in there, and they've taught me more about women than anything I've ever known in my entire life. The Manson girls are in there. There's women in there. Half the women in there are in there for killing a guy like me. When I first walked into that meeting and took the message of Alcoholics Anonymous in there, you could cut the hate with a knife in there. And today, after 12 years, I'm the only father that some of those women have ever known. And some of them little gals have been in there their whole life, 20, 25, 30 flat years in there. You know. I'll never forget the day that one of them little gals in there told me, said, you know, I was standing in my living room and my husband, drunken husband, shot my daughter. Laid the gun down, and I picked the gun up. I was stone cold sober, and I shot him. When the cops came, I couldn't prove that I didn't kill them both. I'm doing two double life. And she asked me, can you forgive yourself for that? Can you forgive them? Standing in that penitentiary, and a lady comes up to me and said, teach me about forgiveness. I said, what do you mean about forgiveness? She said, teach me about forgiveness. Said, I was a week away. I'd done 19 flat years in here, and I was a week away from getting out, and I was standing in the yard, and some girls come up. Stuck a lady standing next to me with a potato peeler, and then put the potato peeler in my hand and turned around and ran away, and I'm doing another life. And every time I go in there and talk to those people, they want to know if I could forgive the people that stuck the potato peeler in my hand. And she said, is it possible to forgive them for that? And I said, you betcha. You betcha. She said, how can you prove that? And I said, because. What did you get in here on your first sentence? And she said, I killed a guy like you. And I said, and then you're standing right here right now asking me to teach you about forgiveness. And I know. I know. And she's paroled right now. She's out. And she's going to meetings with Alcoholics Anonymous. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Stand in that room and listen to girls talk about things. But, they've been in there for over 20 years and never shared with anybody inside that penitentiary. And they build a trust in that meeting to stand in front of that meeting and share their story. Unbelievable. Unbelievable forgiveness. You know why I can do that? You know why it means so much to me? Because in early sobriety, my wife was sponsoring girls and she'd bring them to the house. And my sponsor and people told me I had to treat these ladies, these newcomers that come to my house, these newcomer women, I had to treat them with decency and respect, that I had to act in my own home and learn to do it right there. And my wife would bring all these newcomer Al-Anons over at the house, and my daughter would bring these Alateens over at the house. Now, when I was drinking, I never treated anybody with any respect. And I wanted to stay sober, so I believed what they said, and when my wife and daughter bring those ladies and those Alateens, those kids to my house, I'd treat them with respect. I didn't treat them with filth and dirt and talk like that to them. I treated them with respect. And I learned how to do that in my own house. When I had an opportunity to go into that penitentiary, I'm in that penitentiary. I walked in that penitentiary. There's ladies in there that wear those dresses and no underwear. Some of them don't wear no bras or nothing. And I walked in that room and I looked in there and I thought, you know what? They're going to check me. They're going to see if I'm in here to bring the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, if I'm just another one of them old rotten men. Because I'd acted the way I did in my own home, I could walk in there and look straight ahead. I could stand in front of that room and not look down or sideways or whatever, but I could scan the room and I could treat those ladies with decency and respect in that penitentiary that I learned to do sober in my own house, making amends in my own home. Because of that, I built unbelievable trust. You see, that's how I know my trust in God. I know my trust in God. I don't know any other way to build a trust in God. I know it's happened in my life because my life's much simpler, and I share a story with you, and then I shut up. I don't know any way to talk about God other than through action. They say this is a disease of perception. If this is a disease of perception, then I beg of you this. Don't spend too much time in trying to figure out the perception and that you missed when you were drinking. Because that's gone. You were drunk. Pay attention to the perception of today, and I share this story. There was a cobbler man, a beautiful man, a shoemaker. He died, he went to heaven. When he got to heaven, he was standing in front of God, and God said, "Shoemaker, you're a beautiful man. You worked hard all your life. You did everything you could as a good member of the community and a family. You did the best you could, and you were a good man. You only had one flaw." And the shoemaker told God, "Okay, what's that?" God said, "You just never believed 100% in your God." And the shoemaker looked at God, and he said, "You know, if I could have seen you just one time, or if I could have heard your voice just one time, or I could have felt your touch just one time, I would have believed 100%. God said, "Well, you remember one day you were working in your shop and it was a cold day, there was snow on the ground, and you looked out the window and a little girl was going down the street. It was obvious that she was cold and lonely, and you went to the door, you thought of your own daughter who was home and warm in the warmth of your own home, and you went to the door and you invited this little girl in the shop. You had a bench in there, she sat up on that bench, you put your coat around her so she could warm up. And when she sat on that bench, her feet came up, and you could see she had holes in her shoes, the soles of her shoes. Being a shoemaker, you slipped her shoes off, went over and put new soles on her shoes. Came back and slipped them on her feet very gently, and you went back to work. Pretty soon you heard a rustling noise, and you looked up over the counter, and the little girl was leaving. When she got in the door, she stopped, and she turned, and she smiled. And the shoemaker said, "Yeah, I remember that day. I remember the little girl's smile." God said, "Well, another day, there was an old bum come down the street, and he was hungry, lonely, whatever. He came in, and he wanted some money to get something to eat. Took all your money to take care of your own family, so you sat down there on the bench with him. You got your lunch out. You had an extra sandwich. You sat next to him. You broke bread. Without uttering a word, you sat next to this man, and you gave him a sandwich, and you ate, and he ate. When it came time for you to go back to work, you got up, and he stood up, and he stuck his hand out. You broke bread with this old bum, and so you stuck your hand out and you shook his hand." And the shoemaker told God, "I remember the old bum's handshake, no problem." God said, "One more day. A day, you looked out the window of your shop, and a little old lady was going down the street. She was lost and confused, and it was obvious. You went to the door, you thought of your own mother, and you'd like to help this lady, and you found out she'd got separated from her son, was up the street in another shop, and you calmed her down, set her down in your shop. You went up and found her son, brought him back, and united them, and everything was fine. And it came time for her to leave, and because you've been so kind to her, she said, 'Bless you, my son.'" And the shoemaker told God, "Oh, yeah, I remember the little old lady's 'Bless you, my son.' I remember the bum's handshake, and I remember the little girl's smile. No big deal." God said, "It is a big deal. The little girl's smile was my smile. The bum's handshake was my touch. And that little old lady's 'Bless you, my son,' was my voice. I was there all the time. You just couldn't see and you couldn't feel and you couldn't hear. Now, on any given day, I wake up next to that lady. We've been together a long, long time. We fit, butt to gut, we fit. We fit. I wake up early. I got a job. You want to know something about sponsorship? Get a job with a boss. That'll teach you a lot. I got a boss. I wake up 3 o'clock every morning, half for the last 11 years. I go to work. But when I wake up in that bed laying next to that lady, I love to listen to her sleep. She sleeps easy. There's no yelling. There's no screaming. There's no shooting going off. I love to listen to her breathe. I love the smell of surprise. I was stinking drunk. I love to lay there. I do it every morning. And there isn't a day goes by when I don't talk to that lady. She says, baby, I'm grateful for your sobriety, physical sobriety. I'm grateful for that. And knowing where we come from, if I want to believe that's my God talking to me, I can. I know what it's like to stand next to my dad, a man that I hated, and he hated me with a vengeance. Stand next to him, sober. He's sober and I'm sober. And we're putting this lady in her grave that meant something to him. Meant something to him. Never meant nothing to me. Didn't know her much. But she meant something to him. And because I was sober, I could stand next to my dad and bury this lady. And he put his arms around me. And he held me like a father holds his son. And I felt safe. I felt safe with my daddy's arm around me. And I felt a feeling like it's supposed to be. And if I want to believe that's my God touching me, I can, knowing where me and my old man come from, I'll guarantee you. And like always, every time my daughter comes home, you know, people have a lot of problems with their children because they're right there in front of them and you see their pain. For the last 12 years, my wife and I had to We had to surrender that my daughter lives halfway around the world. We had to let her go. Let her go. We hardly ever see her. She sponsors a lot of people, does a lot of things in the program, but we had to let her go. That takes something, too, to let her go and believe what she's doing is right. And occasionally she gets to come home, and like always when she comes home, she comes into L.A., and I get to take her back to the airport, and like always when it's time for her to go, we got a ritual. It ain't podium talk. I'm not talking shit to you. I do it every time. It's important to me. I take her down to that LAX and I take her suitcase and I walk down that deal. You can only go so far in that international terminal. When I get down to the deal, I let her go and I hug her and she walks down and she does it every time. Done it for the last 12 years and she's going to do it next month. And she always stops and smiles. Now knowing where me and her come from, I used to run down the hallway and put my ear down by her mouth and listen to see if she's breathing. It was just a matter of time until I killed her. And standing at LAX like I have for the last 12 years, I watch that little girl go down there and she always stops and smiles. And if I want to believe that's my God smiling at me, I can. Now you can say that ain't right, but you can't say I'm wrong. You can't say I'm wrong because I feel good about me. Now that's my story. You got a story. You got a story. And if you want to know something about perception, baby, let me tell you this. Don't miss the little girl's smile. It's here. Don't miss the bum's handshake. Ask yourself, would you be willing to help a Henry for 12 years to believe that maybe someday, he could get it? Would you be willing to go that far? Would you be willing to accept a thank you? Somebody you didn't know without saying something smart. Don't miss that. Don't get so hung up in the perception shit here that you miss the real stuff. This is real stuff. Don't miss it. It's yours.